the argument from petition.
May it please the court, Mr. Broadus Spivey and Mr. Paul Kinsley will present arguments for petitioner. Mr. Broadus Spivey will open.
May it please the court. My associate's name is pronounced nicely, like my name. It's a little difficult to pronounce. Experience has taught me that this court is very likely already familiar with the briefs and with the transcript in this case.
Glad the word's getting out on that, counsel.
I think the court might extend counsel a little bit more latitude than perhaps is customary if counsel gets a little bit more involved than is even customary, because this case does involve some factors which require a careful reading of the transcript, a statement of facts, and perhaps a refusal to yield to the temptation of emotion, perhaps more so than in most cases, but this case truly does involve some very repulsive facts. Facts which are in practicality uncontroverted for the purpose of this proceeding. The respondent contends that the appellant was, the petitioner was.
How about calling him by name, counsel? That's easier for
you. All right, it's easier for me. Thank you.
Right. Yeah.
Lukowicz is the respondent, of course, and
he's a petitioner.
Petitioner.
That's the reason for calling him Lukowicz.
The other fellow is Silton. Silton basically owns three corporations. The main corporation is a United States corporation and is a California corporation. Silton Brothers Incorporated. And it operates under the Makia concept, or twin plan or twin sister concept. I assume that has been presented to this court before in other cases, and it is explained in our brief. It's very important to appreciate the relationship in this particular case, that this is a leather goods manufacturer, and raw goods are presented from the American side to the Mexican side. They're converted into finished product, and without any sale or distribution on the Mexican side, which is prohibited by law, they're transferred back to the American side for sale and consumption. And Silton maintains that they had a loss of confidence and that Lukowicz was embezzling or abusing its confidence, as the Mexican law would term it. For the purposes of this presentation only, let me suggest that it would be appropriate to even consider that Lukowicz had, quote, abused the confidence of Silton. Assume that fact, and assume the facts as badly as you can against Lukowicz, and in favor of Silton. I don't know that this court would be inclined to take a judicial notice of the horror of the Juarez jailer, because that's a significant factor in this case. The evidence is undisputed about the terrible conditions of the Juarez jailer. The fact must be considered that these are citizens of the United States, though they were immigrants originally, the Lukowicz. They were citizens hired by Karen International, which is a subsidiary corporation, wholly owned corporation of Silton. Subsequently, Lukowicz was made a partner, is the way they referred to him. We would call him a stockholder, and by virtue of the arrangement, just barely a minority stockholder. In the Karen International, or the Juarez Mexico Corporation. Now, what's important, I think, at this stage is considering the date relationship of the factual events that occurred, because what we're going to have to consider in this case, I think, was there duress? But it's not a question of just was there duress. Silton maintains that there can be no duress, and they referred to the new, what I'll call the new case. It didn't have a Southwestern Reporter number. They've attached it, CF&I Steel Corporation. They've attached it to the brief. And they maintain, and I think that accurately states their position, that the courts of Texas have consistently followed the rule as a matter of law. One, that there can be no duress unless there's a threat to do some act, which a party threatening has no legal right to do. Two, there must be some illegal exaction or some fault or deception. And three, the restraint must be imminent, such as to destroy free agency without the present means of protection. I don't really quarrel with Silton's position, except to say that that is neither a complete statement of the law of duress, nor is it an accurate assumption of the law of duress as it applies in this case. Because, generally speaking, under Texas law, as pointed out in our brief, any coercion of another, either mental, physical, or otherwise, causing him to act contrary to his own free will or submit to a situation or condition against his own volition or interest, constitutes duress. But we go a step farther than that. In this case, we have a different concept of duress than a general concept. A concept of duress which was presented to the El Paso Court of Civil Appeals, but which the El Paso Court of Civil Appeals apparently ignored because their opinion is silent as to that concept. And it says where there's an arrest for an improper purpose without just cause, or where there's an arrest for just cause but without lawful authority, or for just cause but for an unlawful purpose. And the rule is that in either of those events, the party arrested, if he was thereby induced to enter into a contract, may avoid it as one procured by duress. The El Paso Court ignored, in its opinion, the Supreme Court of Texas, 1871 opinion, that's still the law, cited in our brief, Phelps versus Zuschlag, if I can call it the Zuschlag case, because there's not many Zuschlag cases for identity. The common law rule that imprisonment under due process of law and for probable cause is not such duress as would invalidate a contract by the party while under arrest has been materially modified by elementary writers and judicial decisions. And the better and more reasonable rule is believed to have been adopted by authority that when an arrest for probable cause is made under lawful authority but for an improper purpose, and the person arrested pays money or enters into any contract, the object of which is to procure his enlargement, such arrest will be considered duress of imprisonment, and the party arrested may recover back the money so paid or avoid any contract made for the purpose of procuring his liberty. Now let's pass to those dates that I suggest to this court are extremely vital. Consider that in June of 1975, Lukowicz was hired by Karen International. In May of 1978, he began to negotiate with a competitor for employment. In July 1978, Silton began to negotiate with Lukowicz for a partnership, and in fact, in September of 1978, they entered into their partnership, or ownership of stock, I think, is the more accurate description. But backdated it to July of 78 by Silton's own hand and his own volition. That wasn't Lukowicz's deal. Now, at almost instantaneously, and interestingly, in September of 1978, the same period of time, Dave Warden, his general manager, and Mr. Stelton began an investigation of Lukowicz, as I said, for conversion. Early in 1979, Mr. Lukowicz began to hear rumors about his being jailed and about being fired. And he asked Stelton about it. That's uncontroverted. And it's uncontroverted that in February of 1979, a telex, or telegram, I like to call it. It's not quite the same, I think, was sent by Stelton to Lukowicz, and I want to refer to that in a moment. But it's February of 79. In March 14th of 1979, Warden and Stelton arranged for a meeting. Mr. and Mrs. Lukowicz, who lived in El Paso, a luncheon meeting, mind you, but the meeting was to be at the Karen plant in Juarez, at this time unknown to Lukowicz, but well known to Warden and Stelton. They had not only police stationed outside the door, but they had prearranged for lawyers on both sides of the border. Two highly skilled and competent Mexican lawyers were on the Mexican side, and an entire firm, and a large firm, a major firm, standing by on the United States side. On that same day, he was presented an option. Sign this confession, or you will go to jail. Mr. Lukowicz refused to sign that confession. He was transported immediately to jail, and within 1 hour, instantaneously on the American side, documents were filed in court. And it doesn't take much of an examination of those documents to appreciate that, as with all the machinery that private offices, not the courts, have, 1 hour is too short a time to prepare those documents. Then transpired 4 months of horror that I think we, who consider ourselves civilized, refined, and of some level of dignity, find it difficult to identify with and find it difficult to appreciate. And I think that we have a tendency to subconsciously refuse to consider this type of evidence. It's like a novel. Isn't that bad? And you turn the pages and turn the book down. But during those 4 months, it's imperative that this court consider what happened. Number one, during that 4 months, Lukowicz did not confess. There was no conviction. There was no trial. And during those 4 months, Lukowicz was treated badly, and that's an understatement.
Weren't he and his wife both conceded?
Yes, sir. And Mrs. Lukowicz was treated horribly, and that's an understatement. Because Mrs. Lukowicz suffered indignities that the worst of criminals anywhere in this world, not just the United States, should not have to endure. Now let's step back for just a moment and see what it is that makes a conclusive finding of the evidence of duress in this case. And I suggest to this court, by consideration of the dates and the sequence of events in this case, combined with these facts. Number one, Lukowicz negotiates with a competitor, then Shelton gives him a raise, gives him part of the stock, becomes a partner. Now Lukowicz is a partner, not just an employee. Lukowicz and Shelton are now, at least in their terms, partners, or stockholders may be the more appropriate term. And at the same time, almost simultaneously, with entry into this partnership or stock co-ownership, the telex of February 1979, and may I please read that short one sentence to this court. After Lukowicz had heard rumors of being jailed and fired, this telex came from Stelton. Now, please understand, if I may say, Your Honor, this is evidence separate and aside from Lukowicz, so that you don't have to pass on the credibility or expect review the court's passing on the credibility of the liquor witch. Mr. Shelton confirmed this, Helic. Nothing has changed in our excellent relationship. You have my confidence, as you did for over 3 years. Consider fact number two, that at the time Mr. and Mrs. Lukowitz were placed in the Juarez jail, defendants knew that remaining on the American side, the same side where they had a battery of lawyers and a file of papers ready to file, were five little children for whom those provisions were made, and for whom no care was present, and who were the natural and legal children of Mrs. Lukowitz and Mr. Lukowitz. And they admitted that. And consider that for 4 months, no concern was shown by these defendants, Silton, nor by their lawyers on the American or Mexican side. Consider that there were criminal charges pending in Mexico, civil charges pending on the American side. Consider, as on page 10 of our brief, it is set out that these actions were by their own words, their own lawyers' testimony, coordinated. Consider that Shelton had gone to the FBI on the American side, and the FBI had refused to entertain the case. And if it was a crime, certainly it was a federal crime. And yet the FBI on the American side had refused to entertain criminal charges. Consider that in Mexico, the defendants knew that there was no bail for abuse of confidence. And the defendants, and Shelton knew that. At this time, I think it is entirely appropriate to spend just a moment, because of the legal implications of the facts in this case about the horror of the Juarez jail.
It wouldn't be much better if they hadn't been horrible, would it?
Pardon?
Wouldn't be too pleasant if they were not horrible.
No, Your Honor, it wouldn't be too pleasant. But I think it's not only important that these conditions were horrible, but that the defendant knew that these conditions were horrible.
My point, if I have one, is it shouldn't turn on how bad the jail conditions are.
It shouldn't turn on it, but it should not be ignored, Your Honor. Because...
Were they ever taken before a magistrate?
Pardon?
Were they ever taken before a magistrate?
Several times they were taken before a magistrate. Each time he refused to sign the confession. And not only that, but he was visited over almost daily for periods of time by their lawyer, presented with a confession to sign, and he refused to sign it. But it's important to know not only what Mrs. Lukowitz was subjected to, but the fact that the record proves that not only did Mr. Lukowitz know it, but the lawyers for Shelton and Shelton and Warden themselves knew that she had to sleep on a bench, she had to sleep on the floor, in the jail kitchen, she had rats running around her, she was forced to use the bathroom on the floor. She heard nightly beatings of prisoners. She saw, experienced one prisoner beaten to death in her presence. She completely lost her appetite, had to be fed intravenously, lost 30 to 40 pounds. And Mr. Villagarza corroborated, the attorney for Shelton, corroborated these conditions. And these, not just Ms. Lukowitz's testimony, but it's corroborated by their own attorney's testimony. She developed terrible tremors and was almost constantly crying. Now the reason this must be appreciated, and it must be considered, is that we have a man 4 months in prison refusing to sign a confession that the defendant, that Shelton was demanding. Next, that they had, and by their own testimony, their own lawyer's testimony, they had no intention of allowing the Lukowitz's release from jail until the Lukowitz signed an agreement admitting liability for the debt owed response. Why? Why? It's not in our brief, and I didn't realize we had it included in our brief, but it is in the transcript. Silton admitted that after Lukowicz did finally sign this document to obtain his wife and his release, that they then filed on a fidelity bond. He said he didn't remember how much that bond, it was substantial, but it did file on a fidelity bond. And I think this court can take judicial notice of the legal requirements for recovery on a fidelity bond. And isn't it an essential step to furnish proof of embezzlement, of abuse of confidence? Consider the fact that Silton's own representative Warden admitted by his testimony, telling Lukowicz that if they did not confess, they would remain in jail for 14 years. And this was during the 4 months' time they had no trial. There was no sentence passed. And telling them at the same time, simultaneously, if they confessed, the fraud appeal would be dropped. That is, the Siltons would drop their opposition that the Lukowicz would be allowed to get out of jail and return to America. Consider also that the American documents were unquestionably, and by Silton's lawyer's own evidence, prepared entirely by them while the Lukowicz were in custody in Juarez, and consider that one of the provisions of those documents in the affidavit is, at the request of Mauricio Lukowicz and Lucy Lukowicz. At the request of. Consider that within 1 hour of their arrest, those American documents were filed and it was coordinated, but that the jail and the American lawsuits were to be instituted only if Lukowicz failed to sign the confession. Now that citation is given in our brief, but also during this period of time, the Lukowicz were allowed to retain American lawyers who made several trips over there, who the lawyers themselves told Shelton's people and attorneys, no, our clients maintain their innocence. We cannot in good conscience tell them to sign this. Finally, Dave Driscoll testified that he did approve the content because when he finally saw Lucy Lukowicz after 4 months of imprisonment, he realized that she was going to be a dead woman if she didn't get out of prison. And he said, all right, I will approve the form of these documents. But three things he failed to approve or participate in. One, he refused to approve the content. Two, he refused to witness the signing of those documents. And three, he refused to testify and was requested to testify and refused. Consider evidence also, aside from the Lukowicz themselves, of the psychiatrist, Dr. Brock Morris, who hospitalized Lucy Lukowicz after she got out, hospitalized her for several days, fearful that she would take her own life. Consider that the five documents that were signed by the Lukowicz to get out of jail of themselves bear some significance and of themselves require some attention. On July the 10th, 1979, the Lukowicz signed a compromise settlement agreement which included, of all things, a covenant not to compete for 5 years. A unilateral release of all claims, a unilateral one-way release of all claims against the respondents, an affidavit of voluntariness, a consent judgment, including an award of $270,000, and free warranty deeds, including their homestead, the house, they lived in the house that their children had occupied. Consider that the defendant, to prove the, quote, voluntariness of this quote confession, took with their legal representatives to Juarez to, quote, unbiased, disinterested American attorneys. Young men who got to see the Lukowicz for a few scant moments, asked them if it was voluntary on their part. Yes. Consider that these two young men, for a bare hour's work, received $650 each paid by the defendant, by the way, out of funds that were taken and appropriated from the Lukowicz. And turn to the next point that this court granted writ on, and that is public policy. And I suggest to this court that the Texas courts have repeatedly said that there is a public policy, and have said that where a contract, promissory note, or settlement agreement or release is executed by a party in consideration or even partly in consideration for an agreement to drop the prosecution of such party, the agreement is contrary to public policy and unenforceable, and it is an American agreement. It is a Texas agreement that we're seeking to set aside, and which we say the evidence shows uncontroverted in excusing the Lukowicz's own testimony, but considering only the defendant's testimony and the evidence that they show, and the uncontroverted testimony and evidence in record, that it is contrary to public policy and should be set aside. And I often have said in some talks I do to medical students and law students that I think the medical schools and law schools in this country are deficient in their curriculum, because they don't have required courses for graduation, a course in humanity and a course in humility, and I believe that. I believe that we lawyers, as well as the medical profession, are guilty of trying to operate, if not in ignorance of, at least in disregard of humanity and humility. And I say to this court that the very concept of justice requires a consideration of humanity and humility, and if those concepts are considered, then a reversal of this case is mandated. Thank you.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. On the subject of public policy, what's your response to the argument in respondent's brief that, I guess in line with humility, this court should give comity to the way Mexican law handles suspected embezzlers? That is, if they will confess, there won't be any prosecution.
I don't really think that's germane to the thrust of our argument. And I'm not talking about the court's question, I'm talking about respondents' argument. Because it's not just whether a law was violated, as I said at the outset, and it's not just whether we give dignity to a foreign concept, because assuming the same thing happened in America, it would still violate the minimum level of decency which I think we can operate with in our judicial system. I think likewise, and I cannot cite the statute to this court, that our statute has on application of laws, whether domestic or foreign, has been modified some in recent years. And I don't question that. The general concept is that we should give comity to not only Mexican but all foreign decrees to the operation of laws.
Are you suggesting that we hold that the way Mexicans do it is beneath the minimum level of human decency?
No, I don't think we have to do that. I think this is a case that requires the application of the facts to this case. I don't think this is a precedent-setting or a shattering case. I don't think it affects the law of comity, and I don't think the law of comity affects this case, because the case, the facts of this case, raise this case out of the ordinary course of events, because you have conduct on the part of the defendant that created a condition that now allows them to claim the comfort of comity, and it simply doesn't apply to this case.
You're suggesting that duress applies no matter where it occurs.
If, as in this particular case, the duress originated as the business originated in America, and they had the option. They had the option, and they knew the alternatives of the option, and they testified that they knew the alternatives of the option, and they knew that these people would be held interminably without bond, and that's an essential part of duress in this case.
Counsel, what documents were given force and effect on the American side? There was a garnishment proceeding. Understood there was a deed to the homestead.
Deed to the homestead and two other pieces of real estate.
What other American side documents are in or out of court were given force and effect?
There was money in a savings box. The testimony was Mrs. Lukowicz's money from her mother. I don't remember the amount, but it seemed like it was about $10,000 that they appropriated, and it required them to forgive, required the Lukowicz's to release them from any claims they had. There were a number of transactions that is my recollection, were supported by documents. The five central documents that we put forth were the five documents that were placed in court. There were some other documents, and in fact, of course, the release and the affidavit, the unilateral release and the affidavit of voluntariness covered the waterfront, covered all of Shelton's conduct. And there were other things of value taken.
Tell me about the judgment in this case.
Yes, and I was going to ask you the same thing. As I understand, the mechanical problem we have is the overruling of a motion for new trial.
Yes.
Do you attach that up? Is that a matter of abuse of discretion or what? What do we hold with regard to the overruling of the motion for new trial?
I think it's appropriate to hold that it's an abuse of discretion, but I don't think this court has to go that far. And the reason I do is that the court that passed...
Before I answer Judge Polk's question at the same time, he asked you about the judgment, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. Then we'll get to the motion for new trial. Excuse me.
All right. The judgment was signed by the same judge.
What did the judgment do? Was it a judgment for money and a judgment for garnishment?
There was a judgment for money.
Was real estate sequestered or anything?
It had been. There had been two garnishment procedures. One had been abandoned, and I think the other garnishment procedure was subsequent. And these were culminated. My recollection is that there were three causes of action filed originally by Shelton, and I'll ask Mr. Knisley, who can obtain that, to answer that question if I could, please, because he can tell you without any delay with a great deal of accuracy than I can.
All right, and then within X number of days after the judgment was rendered, a motion for new trial was filed.
Yes, sir.
Same proceedings?
Timely, yes, sir.
I see.
And to answer the rest of your question, Mr. Justice Greenhill, on the abuse of discretion, I suppose if I were writing an opinion, I would say an abuse of discretion, but I don't think it's necessary to go that far.
Well, it was a default judgment, as I understand it.
Agreed judgment.
It was agreed judgment.
Agreed judgment.
It was signed in Mexico, isn't that right?
The judgment, the agreement to the judgment.
Mechanically, what I meant,
yes.
And not sympathy.
Yes.
So forth.
I understand.
Okay.
But it was signed by the Lukowicz.
The agreed judgment was signed in Mexico, is that right?
Yes. No, it was not signed by the court in Mexico.
No, I mean signed by the parties.
Approval. The approval was given in Mexico.
And then there was no appearance of the Lukowicz when the agreed judgment... The agreement was put into a judgment, is that right?
That is correct. There was no appearance either by the Lukowicz personally or by their lawyers.
They signed it on the 10th. It was presented to the court and signed by the court on the 11th. The Lukowicz was still in jail, or were they...
No, they signed it, I believe, on the 10th. I don't remember whether it was the 10th or the 11th, but they signed it one day and it was presented to the court 3 p.m. that same day.
Oh, I see. And Lukowicz was then released from jail the next day.
Subsequently, the Lukowicz, after the Texas court approved it, the Lukowicz were released from jail and then transported, I think, to the station on the border, so to speak. And then the next morning, they were processed on through.
Can you tell us, or will you defer, as to whether or not the consent judgment incorporated all these other elements that you've talked about, like the conveyance of the homestead?
My recollection is that it did.
The release and so forth.
My recollection is that these documents are intertwined, that the compromise settlement generally encompasses everything, and a judgment affirms the compromise settlement, is the technical way that it was achieved.
If we send the case back, how do we get fact findings on the motion for new trial? Or do we say, are we required to say that the motion for new trial should have been granted and
yes.
Set the case for trial on its merits?
Yes, Your Honor.
What would that be? What would the trial on the merits
be? Trial would be to set aside these documents on the basis of duress. And that's why I say it would not take a finding of abuse of discretion, but simply because I think the legal issue here is, well, as a matter of law, duress in this case. And I think that's what the finding of the court should appropriately be. Duress, what's the term I said just a moment ago? The Zuschlag case referred to it as duress by imprisonment. And it's not every imprisonment while consent is given or signature given that would constitute duress by imprisonment.
Thank you, counsel. The argument from the respondent.
May I please the court? Mr. Donald Higgins will present argument for respondent.
May I please the court? My name is Don Higgins, and with Tony Stompe, we are appearing here today on behalf of El Paso Apparel Corporation.
He gave you the gun smoke pronunciation, Higgins.
I don't know if I'm related to Festus or not. Your Honor, during the course of this presentation, I'd like to divide my time into three segments. First of all, I take substantial issue with the rendition of facts given by Mr. Spidey, and I'd like to break down an analysis of the facts.
A little louder, please.
I'd like to break down an analysis of the facts in four different categories. The first has to do with Silvan's perception of what was occurring. The second has to do with the Lukowitz's, their perception of what was occurring, precisely what they did. Thirdly, the Lukowitz's attorneys in Juarez and El Paso and what they were doing in their perception. And finally, the courts on both sides of the border in their perception of what is occurring. Because I think in his analysis of the facts, Mr. Spivey interweaves some of these things, and I don't think that proper factual conclusions are really reached. Secondly, I'll talk about the duress slash voluntariness issue, in other words, whether or not these documents are executed voluntarily. And finally, I will talk about whether or not there was indeed valid and legal consideration in this particular case, which is the second point of error on which this court granted the writ. First, talking about the facts, I'd like to give a little background. The substantive basis for this proceeding has to do with five documents that were executed in July of 1979. These documents included a compromise settlement agreement that's highly detailed, that includes attached to the compromise settlement agreement the statements of numerous witnesses that appeared before Notario Público in Juarez, Mexico, indicating the guilt of both Mauricio Lukowitz and his wife, Lucy Lukowitz. This compromise settlement agreement was approved as to form by an American attorney and was signed by both Lukowitzes with the presence of a Mexican attorney in Juarez. Secondly, there's a consent judgment that was approved as to form by an American attorney that was signed in Juarez by the Lukowitzes and was approved by them. Next, there's a release of all claims that's tangential to the compromise settlement agreement that was signed by the Lukowitzes and approved as to form by their attorney. And finally, there's an affidavit of voluntariness wherein each of these documents is specifically delineated. The acknowledgement that they're yielding their homestead and their acknowledgement of their legal rights is fully set out. And they specifically state that they fully understand precisely what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Now, I'd sign all of those if somebody had a gun to my head.
Yes, Your Honor, but in this particular instance, there was no gun to Lukowitz's head.
Well, I guess that's the problem, isn't it?
Your Honor, that's right. This is no different than a situation in the United States. If Mr. Lukowitz and Mrs. Lukowitz were guilty of a crime, were in prison in the United States, you'd have basically the same set of facts and circumstances. No guns being held to their head. They're guilty of a crime and they're facing a substantial period of imprisonment.
Who determined that guilt?
Yeah, who said?
Okay. Let me back up a step. With respect to Juarez and what occurred in Juarez, the evidence of the record is clear, and there was no evidence presented by Mr. Spivey that anything occurred in Mexico other than was totally legally valid in Mexico with respect to the
proceedings. Has there been a finding of guilt or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
In the Mexican jail?
Mexican, yes, Your Honor.
In court?
There was a hearing in Mexico. If I can back up just one step. First of all, this went to Notario Público, who reviewed the evidence, took it to the judicial police.
That's the notary public.
Notary public, that's right. And in Mexico, you have to be an attorney, and there are only 20 attorneys in Juarez that are Notario Público. They have powers much broader than the notary powers in the United States. They have the power to investigate crimes. They have the power to bring proceedings. Notario Público investigated it, took full statements as to the guilt of these individuals. Then it went to the judicial police who arrested them. Then it went to a magistrate who had a hearing, who had all the people in the room as to the statements and whether the statements were valid. These people were told that within 4 months they'd be tried for their offenses. They tried in Ampato, which is effectively the same thing as a habeas corpus, which is denied. and Lucy Lukowitz maintained she wasn't guilty and the umpire was denied. Additionally, with respect to the two issues in the case, there was a fraud issue, which was on appeal. In other words, and the appeal wasn't from Silton Brothers personnel. The appeal had to do with whether or not there would be, continue to be a fraud claim against these people, and also abuse of confidence, which is an embezzlement claim. All this was before the court. These individuals pled guilty in the courtroom. The other evidence was available to the judge, and he found them guilty. As part of...
When did he find them guilty?
Okay, Your Honor, the day that they pled guilty.
The day they signed the agreement.
They signed the agreement, because that had to do with the restitution. And
well, this, they were found guilty after they pled guilty.
Yes, Your Honor.
After signing these documents.
Yes, Your Honor. But these documents were tied into restitution in Mexico, because in Mexico, you have the right, under certain circumstances, to pardon individuals who have committed a crime against you if they make full restitution. And that's precisely what occurred here. In other words,
the creditor holds the key to the jail.
In a way. The United States is not all that different in that, for instance, with respect to terms and conditions of probation, the court has full latitude with respect to making restitution also.
Is there any controversy over the fact whether or not Silton rehired all the witnesses against Lukowitz and put them back to work?
No, Your Honor,
they made their statements.
If I can explain what happened in that regard, the investigation was occurring with respect to Lukowitz. Mr. Silton obviously wasn't going to tell Mr. Lukowitz that this was going on, because you're talking about very substantial sums of money that were taken over a long period of time. While the investigation was occurring, Mr. Lukowitz was firing various people that he thought might tell on him or that he had a problem with. And all Silton did was continue the people on the payroll once they were fired.
Counsel, some of us may be worried about not whether we decide whether it was duress or not, or overreaching or not, but whether these people are entitled to trial on whether there was or wasn't.
Well, they had a full proceeding, Your Honor, before the judge below as to whether or not duress occurred or didn't occur.
Now, who found the facts? Did you get a jury trial on that?
No, Your Honor, the judge made the determination below as to whether or not there was duress or not duress. That was
Did he make findings of fact?
None was requested by the appellant or by the petitioner in this case. He could have requested findings of fact and conclusions of law, and he didn't do it. We would submit there's a full hearing on the duress issue before the lower court. And let me back up a little bit and go ahead and go into the facts.
When you explain those employees, Silton found the employees who had been fired by Lukowitz. Lukowitz got statements from them that Lukowitz was stealing, and then he put them back on the payroll. Is that the order of it?
Not quite, Your Honor. That's the way it would indicate Mr. Spivey's brief. But if you read the statement of facts, basically what happens, most of these people were talked to in January, February, March of 1979. Already talked to by Dave Warden.
Had they been in prison and were released upon giving the statements, as the brief says?
Not really. See, there are two separate sets of statements. One statement was taken early on by Dave Warden and Notario Publico when they're investigating. Another statement was made before the magistrate when they gave their statements after arrest before the magistrate. The individuals we're talking about with respect to the statements are not the individuals that were arrested at a later point in time. Okay. What happened was Dave Warden was making the investigation. Then these individuals made statements to Warden. Lukowitz fired.